I vowed always to listen to only me. In 1996, I received one of those, here's $3,500, USD, for a happy Christmas. Just sign the back of this check, where it outlined how much I would pay over whatever period of time I took to repay this alleged loan if indeed I cashed the check. I loved it. I mozzied over to my bank, endorsed the check and was handed $3,500 FRNs. They were right, I did have a happy Christmas that year. When they sent me a 14 statement about a month later, trying to collect something from me which not only didn't exist but also didn't cost them anything other than postage and printing, I requested proof of their loss. They were flummoxed. They didn't lend me anything. Understand that banks do not qualify you in order not to lose dollar, they qualify you in order to gain dollar, they don't want to lend to educated customers. They can't lose anything they never lent. I hear where your ego just took you. Well, you got something for nothing. No, I didn't, I sold my signature for $3,500 a good price back in 1996. All I got was $3,500 in debt notes. Since then, I've done the math. My signature is now worth $15 billion, CAD. Then they got really jumpy and sent me threatening letters. I asked that they show me their loss. What loss could they possibly have sustained? Is my bank out any dollar? No, its books are balanced since they were electronically credited by the other bank. There's only one bank. Is the other bank out any dollar? No, the returned check with my signature was their credit. So their books were balanced. Were my books balanced? Of course. My debit was my signature and my credit was the cash. It is all just bookkeeping entries. Who owes what to anyone? The transactions are complete. It was simply an exchange of debit/credit. Why would I give them anything more than what I already gave them my signature, which is by the way, by far more valuable than $3,500 because they will lend funds against my signature many times, earning them, depending upon the rate of interest, an unlimited number of times that amount. This is called fractional banking and they're not apprising me of this is called bank fraud. So in fact I did them a huge favor by selling them my signature. They informed me that I had not repaid my loan. This is called double billing. Double billing is fraudulent. Have you ever gone crazy when a corporation spends 50 cents on a stamp to send you a bill for 11 cents? You wonder what they're smoking to make such a fiscally inane blunder and yet, this is fabulous evidence for the fact that it has nothing to do with dollar, rather the balancing of their books. Their billing you is simply a cost of doing business. In particular, to be certain that the credits balance the debits on their ledger. The money the banks issue is merely bookkeeping entries. It costs them nothing and is not backed by their wealth, efforts, property, or risk. From 1913 until 1933, the U.S. paid interest with more and more gold. The structured inevitability soon transpired. The treasury of the United States government was empty, the debt was greater than ever. And the U.S. was forced into involuntary bankruptcy. This means that the Crown laid claim to everything. In exchange for using notes belonging to bankers who create them out of nothing, based on our credit, we are forced to repay in substance our labor, property, land, productivity, businesses, and resources in ever-increasing amounts. At that time I did not know what I know today and so they did put a smudge upon my credit record yet it was worth it because at that point, with a black mark anyway, I figured that I might just as well ring up all the credit cards and ask the same question. The upshot was that I lived about 3 years without credit but since I came away with about $50,000 USD worth of credit along with the education on how not to repay more than double for something I never received, it was well worth it. Meanwhile, the process has improved and I intend there to be only temporary black smudges on my credit record. I'm still working on this. My signature is worth whatever I say it is at any given instance. I signed for $10,000 credit with MBNA Bank. They sold my signature for who knows how much. After I used all the credit I had created, I discharged their debt. Yes, their debt, I allowed them to use my credit, via my signature, and they created the debt in order to balance their books. Now they wanted me to send them over $11,000. I asked them to send me a copy of the contract between Mary, the name in uppercase letters, and MBNA. I guess they couldn't find it, maybe because it never existed. I also asked them for validation of the debt, record of their accounting, and verification of their claim against me, since what I am called, Mary, was nowhere on the alleged contract. They began to telephone asking me to send them $$$$ yet never put anything in writing. What does this tell you? They had no valid claim. I told them I was very willing to pay any obligation I might owe, if they could provide proof of their claim. They could not. They were incapable of substantiating their claim. I never received anything from them suggesting that the manner in which I had paid them was insufficient, unacceptable, improper, or failed to discharge the debt. Besides, I did pay them, in fact I paid them more than double. They had my original signature and I also sent them another signature attached to the final amount they claimed I owed them, not to mention a few hundred I sent while I was busy ringing up the card, so they made a killing off me. If they had a legal leg to stand upon, they most certainly would have written to me, not to mention sent their legal counsel after me, which they did threaten, by the way, but only over the telephone, never on paper. Idle verbal threats have no lawful clout. I never stiffed anyone. The contract they believe I had with them was invalid because there was no full disclosure, one of the requirements of a valid contract. It was not spelled out to me that they were in the business of perpetrating fraud upon unsuspecting people. Since most people are willing to have their funds 15 fraudulently confiscated, they generally leave people like me alone. They don't want to let the cat out of the bag. It would mean the demise of their racket, not to mention the entire economic system. But isn't this what we want? It isn't working for us 99% of the world's population. It's working for only them 1%. About a year later, MBNA did in fact file suit against the entity listed on the credit card account. Even according to Financial Consumer Agency of Canada, MBNA are thugs and they advise consumers to avoid them. MBNA is particularly vicious and the reason is because they have their own legal team. They don't sell their accounts to third-party collection agents, as most credit card banks do. Collection agents have no standing in law because they are interlopers and never contracted with the entity they claim owes them, hence they are powerless to collect on deficiencies. Rather than produce for MBNA my plethora of documents evidencing that they were in dishonor, as they failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted, that I had accepted their offer and returned it thereby vitiating any controversy requiring adjudication, I just settled and closed the accounting. First, I apprised the Minister of Finance that I would be authorizing MBNA to use my exemption via a pre-authorized transfer and unless he could rebut my position with relevant, specific, lawful authority and how it applies to me, I'd go ahead and send MBNA a transfer instrument, which I did. I made sure that I created a contract with my terms and conditions between MBNA and me. After I sent a notice of agreement, a statement of account showing the balance as zero, and a confirmation of agreement that the accounting was settled and closed, I never heard from them again. I figure $14,000 from my $15 billion isn't going to hurt me. A major law firm in Toronto threatened to sue me, on behalf of their client, CIBC, for about $11,000. We exchanged a few letters and finally I wrote, "I am not a corporation or a government-created fiction. I do not give you permission to make a legal determination about me or the entity you are accosting. You have failed to provide evidence of a contract between Mary and law firm, also evidence of your consideration, and you have failed to sign your offer of contract under penalty of perjury. Said failure constitutes your agreement that you are a third-party interloper, you have no legal standing, no first-hand knowledge of the matter, and your claim is fraudulent." I never heard from them again. I knew that I had succeeded when I got a call from a collection agent claiming to be collecting for CIBC. I could hardly contain my glee. This confirmed that the law firm had told CIBC that they could not sue me and so, in frustration, CIBC simply sold the account again to yet another collection agent that also threatened to sue me. I told him I look forward to it. You know, I was dying to ask him, if a major law firm in Toronto failed in its attempts to sue me, what makes you think you will succeed? I had no idea that speeding fines in BC are so extortive, yet, I actually like the idea since, the grander the charges for which I can stiff them, the happier I feel. My friend got a ticket for $358 for over 30 kilometers over the speed limit. Apparently, the fine for over 30 kilometers is automatically over $300. I just had her write across the ticket, "Receipt of your offer of contract is acknowledged and hereby returned for discharge and closure for your failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. I do not wish to contract with you. Date, by, autograph, agent." That was the end of that. I ought to mention that since implementing any of the above-listed successful remedies, I have been even more successful with easier, faster, more succinct remedies which I would outline here for you, yet we continually improve them. Is anyone tired of the GST or just sales tax in general? My suggestion for those in biz who are collecting GST for the feds and not being compensated for their time and labor is to enclose an invoice for your fee of maybe 90% for doing their dirty work for them, deduct that from what you have collected, and enclose a check for the remainder. A better idea is to quit charging your customers a tax they are not required to pay. This will give you an edge over your competition who still believe they must charge their clients GST. I am still dealing with collection agents and credit card banks, but I have way more fun with them now. I ask the credit card companies to send me a bill, not a statement, to include a copy of the contract, evidence their consideration, what they gave me, which was nothing, in exchange for the dollar they want, and have it signed under the full, commercial liability of one who can bind their corporation in contract. Since they can't do this and it would be fraud if they did, they pass it along to collection agents who are even more fun because, who are they? I never had any contract with them either. They are all third-party debt collectors slash interlopers. I just tell them to get out of my commercial affairs. I like best the ones who have the attorneys write the letters because the bigger they are, the harder they fall. My latest ploy is I just pay them with a transfer instrument, makes them crazy. The economics of banking is counterfeiting. We have been deceived into thinking that we were lent other depositors' deposited funds. Banksters cause us to think that if we do not pay back those funds, the bank 16 and its depositors will be out the cash. Remember, all you borrowed was monetized credit, which your signature created probably about $100,000, 10% of which they extended back to you. You lent yourself the funds. Why are you paying back anyone? Ask a banker about this, as I did, and watch him stop breathing. If a counterfeiter counterfeits dollar and lends it to us, do we have any moral or legal obligation to repay the loan? No. The law, statute, says counterfeiting is illegal and that we do not have to repay the counterfeiter. But the banksters are careful. The bank's own published manual claims, money does not have to be issued by the government or be in any special form. Money is anything that can be sold for cash and which the banks accept as money. Aren't they a riot? The story about Dan Mahoney, who allegedly defrauded the bank out of several million dollar, and also the story about Frank Abinal in his book Catch Me If You Can never took anyone else's cash. Dan and Frank signed for every note they received. They created the funds themselves. No one lost any dollar, neither the investors in Mahoney's case nor Pan Am employees in Abinal's case. I'll bet to this day, both these men think that they did something illegal. Yet, not one living soul lost any dollar to either of them. The corporate entities pretended theft and had them punished in order to preserve and perpetuate the scam. When you purchase something from a shop and then return it, why are they so intent on getting back your receipt? No, not to prove you paid for it, because you can't pay for anything. This receipt is the evidence of exchange. The goods don't matter, any more than the principal on a loan matters. All they want is the interest. Look at your minimum payment due on your credit card statement, it's only the interest. The loan doesn't exist. They must pay the IMF the interest on the loan. A friend responded, "We don't worry about money, if that's what you're asking." I was glad to hear this, but I know it's only a matter of time. He and his wife are paying, via their labor, probably 4 times the price of their 5-bedroom house, which translates into 30 years of paying for the cost of maybe 6 months' labor plus the supplies it took to build. This disparate ratio seems never to be questioned. Whom are they paying? The banks. For what? Credit. Did they get anything for their labor? You might think they got their house for their labor, yet they did not. They got their house for their signature on the promissory note. Their labor is the confiscation of their lives. The actual process of money creation takes place primarily in banks. Bankers discovered that they could make loans merely by giving their promise to pay, or banknotes, to borrowers. In this way, banks began to create money. Transaction deposits are the modern counterpart of banknotes. It was a small step from printing notes to making book entries crediting deposits of borrowers, which the borrowers in turn could spend by writing checks, thereby printing their own money. Modern money mechanics. Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. I first became aware that all my suspicions about the banking system were accurate when I read Thorin's book, Truth in Money. I learned that all money is borrowed into existence. It doesn't exist until someone borrows it. It is debt-based money, hence it is not really money, since real money is based upon substance, gold, silver, etc. If money is borrowed into existence, then this is all that exists. So, where is the interest? It doesn't exist. How can it possibly be paid? It can't be paid because it is not part of what is created. It simply does not exist. The currency we use is based upon our future labor, which the feds have promised to the banksters. It also does not yet exist. Future generations are already enslaved to pay a debt which does not exist. We can't pay debt with something of no substance. We also need to take a look at how the account statements were created. Goods and services are assigned a value. Everything is only true because someone says so and someone else agrees to it. Do you ever question your bills, which are not true bills in commerce but rather statements of account, not the amount due, but the concept? What if you found out that everything you ever needed or wanted was already paid for? That you didn't owe anyone anything? When you go into a store to buy a book and you pay in whatever manner you choose, what do you get for the payment? No, not the book, you get a receipt. The evidence for this is that the dollar amount on the receipt matches precisely the dollar amount on your payment. It is an exact exchange. The book is not even part of the equation. It was prepaid, all you did was go to the store to claim and retrieve it. In order to understand the concept of prepaid, imagine this: suppose you want to open a restaurant and you just need another $10,000, and so you ask a friend to lend it to you. Knowing that there is no money and the currency your friend has is essentially worthless compared to what he truly wants in his life, he sure wouldn't mind lending it to you. So after a couple of months you ashamedly go to him and say that there is no way you can ever pay him back, what with interest 17 and all, yet you are so ingratiated to him you tell him that he can eat in your restaurant anytime he wants for free. Not only that, but also you would be so grateful if he would, because, alas, it would assuage your guilt. All he is required to do when the waiter presents him with an itemization of his meal is to sign it. He is not required to pay for his meal, it's prepaid. In the same way, our bills are already paid and, in fact, the corporate entity which is billing us would be only too grateful if we would take advantage of our having prepaid them, because then they wouldn't have to pay the tax on the dollar we send them. So all that is required of us is to sign the invoice and return it to them. The telephone company is funded by the government. You and I, and everyone who has a birth certificate or socialist number, have funded the government. So, we have an exemption the same way your friend is exempted from paying for his meals at your restaurant. Why is the telephone company sending us a statement, not an invoice, with an amount owing on it? We paid up front. All goods and services are now lawfully ours just for the asking. For a few years I have been traveling around in my 92 Cadillac, originally registered, licensed, and insured in New Mexico. I can't tell you how many people have told me that I was supposed to have registered it in Alberta within 45 days of its being here. How is it that everyone knows this? Well, that would have been 4 years ago, so I suppose by their standards, I'm slightly overdue. Since I know the difference between registration and recording, I sent the Minister of Transport, I use the ministers of the Canadian government to work for me, a proposal of contract, the terms and conditions of which are that we agree that what I have put on my license plate will identify my automobile as not one of theirs. It is mine. Also, I agree to carry with me a form of identification, which I created, in case there is an incident whereby they require to know who is involved. I enclosed a surety bond as security to settle any claim of liability in the event of an incident requiring compensation from another living soul. I sent a copy to the local gendarmes. If I am asked about proof of insurance, I can honestly respond by providing evidence that I have posted a $1 million bond. The RCMP has been very accommodating whenever I have shown them my international driver permit, which came from my computer. I slapped onto it a pic of me taken by my son and, voila. They pretend their interest is in the expiration date, however, I know they are really noticing that I have nothing which can be construed as their having jurisdiction over me. More on this in the section on licensure. If I'm ever stopped, I have with me evidence of the tacit admission from the minister himself that what I am doing is lawful. If it isn't, he has tacitly agreed to be held culpable. Since I claimed the Cadillac on a UCC-3 addendum to my financing statement, UCC-1, and also on a PPSA, I control the caddy and I can evidence that none of the constabulary can legally confiscate it unless they compensate me for it. Over the date sticker on the plate I put, no EXP, no expiry, a fun thing to do if you are ever stopped by the cops, in response to, can I see your driver's license, please? Is why would I want one of those? There is no answer because what legal lunatic would carry around the very thing which gets him into trouble? I think you're safer with a 38 special on the passenger seat, at least it is not concealed. The only one who requires a driver license is one who is operating in commerce, so, unless you are driving for hire, i.e., driving in commerce, you are not required to have one. Imagine when everyone begins to do what I and many others have done. The PTB will cease to function. The only thing keeping everyone from doing what I do is fear, which is caused from lack of information, time, and clarity on the concept. I intend to change this for you so that you can begin to live your life, doing what you want instead of earning your living. Too many people are working way too hard to pay for, one, things that are already theirs because they are prepaid and all that is required is for them to claim them, and two, charges which they are not required to pay because they are not liable for them in the first place. Since I caught on to how to make contracts work for me, my best example being the confirmation of agreement to the terms and conditions of the contract I have with the Minister of Transport Canada, I decided to have way more fun with this process. I wrote to the Minister of Justice Canada telling him I intended to grow, process, market, sell, transport, possess, and use cannabis, aka marijuana. After 30 days I sent him a confirmation of his agreement to the terms and conditions of our contract, and if I ever opt to grow, sell, and smoke dope, I'll just notify the local RCMP so they know not to bother me. One of the terms of our contract is that if I get into any trouble, he agrees to be culpable. Pursuing this adventure, I wrote to the Premier of the province and also the Provincial Advisor for Procedure Policy for Municipal Affairs and asked them both about property tax. Neither could prove that I am required to pay property tax. The way to stop paying any tax, never mind property tax, is to remember 18 you are a sovereign and begin to behave like one. I intend to show the contract I have with them to those who have what I require. I'll show people my dentist comes to mind how to save thousands per year in property tax, and I'll negotiate with them for whatever I need. Property taxes where I live are $5,000 a year. I also sent a proposal of contract to Messrs. Nymark and McCallum, CRA Commissioner and Minister of National Revenue, along with my tax exemption certificate, begging them to prove where I owe income tax. Time's up. They have tacitly agreed that no one is liable for any tax, not income tax or any of the interminable list of other taxes, service fees, penalties, fines, etc., which keep people working at jobs they don't like and from families they generally do. I estimated that the time I put into writing letters to credit card banks, along with putting up with their annoying calls, etc., works out to no more than 40 hours per creditor. Since the cash I receive from said credit is about $10,000, I realized that this is far more income per hour than I ever earned from the medical mafia. I admit it is inconsistent but certainly more fun. The lawsuit filed by MBNA was one of the highlights of my life. I love this stuff. Knowing that the Toronto law firm which represented CIBC was forced to drop their intended suit due to my letter which let them know that I know who I am was even better. A few years ago I wanted to travel to Oregon. I always get nervous crossing the border, for no reason other than border patrol, like cops, have no sense of personal power so they obtain jobs which make them appear powerful, hence, their insecurity can be annoying. I hadn't yet purchased a flight and so the cost had escalated by the day. By the time I got to the airport the price of the ticket was over $900 USD. I wrote a check on a closed US bank account and my relief that it was accepted assuaged my usual angst over crossing the border. To this day I wonder if the asset funds from my closed check were ever credited to United Airlines or did I play a small role in their declaring bankruptcy only a few months later. For those of you who think I stiffed the airline, think again. The check was written on the private side of the account, the closed side which is not to be confused with the public side which is where the cash comes in. Remember the ticket was prepaid and so the private check simply accessed my exemption. The airline wasn't out anything. Their account was credited, not with cash but with credit via EFT electronic funds transfer. The benefit of this is that the airline didn't have to pay tax on that income since it did not receive fiat money, which is why we are required to pay tax on it. It is not real substance, it is a fabrication of the bankster's mind and they want a fee from us for using it. Since I used real asset funds there was no tax for the airline to pay. They loved me for it. On that flight I picked up one of those classy magazines which sell everything anyone could never need and for Christmas I ordered a bunch of high-ticket items. I sent a closed check written against a US bank account, had the goods sent to a friend in New Mexico and she forwarded it to me. The company wouldn't accept a check for delivery outside the USA. All worked out well except that my friend had sent the goods via FedEx which then sent me a bill for $75 USD. So, I accepted for value their offer and returned it for settlement and closure of the accounting. A month later I received not only another bill but also the summary sheet detailing their claim. I wrote to them asking what they did with my payment. A month later I received another letter which I didn't open immediately. The following day I received a letter from a collection agent claiming they are collecting for FedEx which prompted me to open the FedEx letter. It was an apology for any inconvenience they might have caused me and that the bill was paid in full. I telephoned the collection agent and suggested they contact FedEx whose most recent letter states the account has been paid. End of story. Have you ever taken a check to the bank on which a check was drawn and been told by the bankster that if you don't have an account with the bank she will charge you a fee? The bankster is intending to convince you that she is doing you a favor by cashing the check for you. Nothing could be further from the truth. The bank is acting as fiduciary to its customer who wrote you the check and who also pays the bank a monthly service fee to do so. The drawer is the debtor who owes you, the creditor. He is obliged to come to your house and pay you cash. Since this is inconvenient for him, he writes you a check and hires the bankster to save him the time and trouble. You shouldn't even have to go to the bank, the bankster should drop by your house with the cash. And yet she has the audacity to charge you even though you made the trip. This is a business matter between fiduciary and client and you are not a party to it. Yet, the bankster will do anything to extort funds from you if she can con you into thinking that she is performing a service for you. She is not, she is doing what she was hired, by the bank's client, to do. Don't fall for it. If she insists on charging you, have her call her client to tell him that he has to come to the bank and cash the check himself and hand you the cash. My guess is the client will tell the bankster that he wants to speak to the manager to whom he'll say, I hired you to cash checks for me. What am I paying you for? 19 Part 2